Hi folks, and greetings from Smoky Flagstaff. You're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, bringing you news from the Arizona Daily Sun here in Flagstaff. And we have news today from the Friday, July 3rd edition. And this would normally be the Saturday edition, but because Saturday is the 4th of July, they actually moved publication up a day. So the news that normally would be going into this broadcast for Saturday was actually printed or published on Friday this week. Anyway, before I forget, this is your volunteer reader, Joe. Welcome aboard. Let's get started. First up, we have an article written by SunStaff reporter Abigail Kessler. This is Council Hears Input on Zoning Changes. The Flagstaff City Council moved forward with recommendations that are the outcome of a years-long effort to assess and make changes to city code to help Flagstaff meet its housing and climate goals. City staff first began working on the Land Availability and Suitability Study and Code Analysis Project, which is abbreviated LASS/CAP, in 2023. It has now completed a study of buildable land in Flagstaff, an analysis of city code as it relates to housing and climate goals, and multiple reports on how code can be changed to further these goals. The recommendations are intended to help adjust city code to better align with the goals of Flagstaff's 10-year housing plan, climate action plan, and the 2045 regional plan that was approved by voters earlier this spring. They fall into six categories: increasing maximum density, adding a scaled floor area ratio requirement, reduced parking requirements, requiring a sustainable design baseline, integrating incentive programs into the code, and refining other standards. Of the opportunity sites identified in the LASS, the majority of buildable land, or 82 acres, fell in the R1 zone. Another 26 acres were in manufactured housing, 24 were in medium density residential, 20 were in high density residential, and 13 fell in a commercial zone. Planning and Development Services Director Michelle McNulty and consultant Jameen Kimmel of Cascadia Partners presented on the code recommendations that were developed through the process during the June 16th council meeting. In her introduction of the item, McNulty said the final recommendations had been shaped by feedback from the council and community in response to the draft code concepts that had been presented last August. The city has also made some code changes while moving through this process. The end of the presentation listed more than a dozen areas where Flagstaff had updated its zoning code since 2021 to meet these goals, including changes related to accessory dwelling units and middle housing. Following the presentation, the council unanimously expressed support for moving forward with the recommended changes to city code. Staff will be listing the necessary code recommendations to bring the suggested changes into effect. Then they will seek input from various groups and begin the city approval process. Zoning code manager Tiffany Antal estimated that the combined process of drafting a code amendment and completing internal review and public outreach would take approximately 150 to 180 days. This would be followed by a work session and public hearing with the Planning and Zoning Commission, and finally, a first and second reading by City Council. This part of the process would take around another 107 days to complete. Unit size and density. The first set of recommendations focused on changing density requirements. Kimmel said higher density development also moves Flagstaff toward its climate goals, as it encourages public transit and increases the likelihood that a development includes a mix of housing types. The maximum densities in the current code tend to encourage detached houses rather than this mix of housing, he said, The recommended changes would increase the allowed densities for all zones. Even the lower density zones under these recommended densities would support neighborhoods with that range of housing types, Kimmel said. Central business, the highest density zone under the recommendations, would increase from a maximum density of 29 units per acre to 60 units per acre. This change, according to the presentation, moves from encouraging two- or three-story apartment buildings with the option to apply for a conditional use permit, or CUP, to increase the total of units to encouraging four- to five-story apartments. Kimmel said the recommended maximum densities between 50 and 60 units per acre in commercial zones, compared to the current 29, are meant to be just before the point where additional construction work, such as a taller building or parking structure, would be required, raising construction costs and, in turn, unit prices. Developers seeking to build at a higher density will need to participate in city incentive programs. The changes to density requirements will be accompanied by new floor area ratio, or FAR, requirements, which place a cap on the size of units. This is intended to encourage developers to include a mix of unit sizes rather than building the largest possible unit on the space. Increasing density requirements on their own, Kimmel said, could lead to more large units, which will be less affordable due to their size. Adding a maximum FAR puts a cap on how large those units can be, leading to developments including more units and an attainable size. He also noted that buildings constructed to these standards would be closer in scale to those already existing in the city. A graphic included in Kimmel's presentation showed that increasing maximum density could reduce the sale price in a R1 development by 6%, and both increasing the maximum density and adding a FAR max or an FAR maximum could lead to a 39% reduction in sale price. In the example, the existing code would allow for a duplex in the R1 zone, with each unit being 2,000 square feet and costing $897,000, or about $898,000. Increasing the maximum density would mean four 2,000 square foot units could be developed on the site, with a price for each unit of approximately $846,000. With both increased density and a FAR maximum, the same parcel could have a fourplex with each unit being 1,160 square feet and costing approximately $517,000. The FAR requirements will scale at higher densities to encourage developers of larger projects to build more small units while allowing for a mix of unit sizes in smaller developments. Kimmel said the current code includes barriers to higher density development in commercial zones, which are currently capped at 29 units per acre without applying for a CUP required under high occupancy housing, abbreviated as HOH. He said CUPs are not unreasonable requirements, but the current code requires developments with smaller units to go through the same process as one that includes primarily units that are four bedrooms or more. He said that requirement can be considered a source of risk in making plans. We heard from developers throughout this process that this is a reason why they would not pursue a project, he said. It's a risk that the project could be denied. It's risk that it could be delayed by multiple hearings. It's risk that conditions could be applied on the project that could affect its viability. So it's really a significant barrier to building at higher densities. The code recommendations would allow densities of up to between 50 and 60 units per acre by right, with developments that want to exceed this total needing to participate in city incentive programs. The HOH CUP would remain in place, but instead of being triggered by unit density, it would be required based on bedroom density. We think this is a more targeted and appropriate allocation of that CUP requirement, Kimmel said. It applies to those projects that are both high density and high occupancy, and not just high density. Developers including different tiers of incentives could then have projects with densities of up to 120 units per acre, 70 to 80 units per acre at Tier 1, 90 to 100 at Tier 2, and 100 to 120 at Tier 3. Projects that exceed maximums for bedroom density would require an HOH CUP. Kimmel said the most common concerns he has heard about increasing density is whether the resulting structures will be compatible with the character of Flagstaff's current buildings, and whether there will be enough infrastructure capacity, roads, water, etc. For the former, he said standards that affect the way buildings look, such as setbacks, lot coverage, architectural design standards, and maximum height, would remain the same. He also said the city's current procedures for determining infrastructure and mitigation requirements would remain in place. Parking requirements. The code recommendations also include requirements for developments as a way to reduce construction costs. The average number of required spaces per unit would decrease from 1.75 spaces per unit to between 1 and 1.25 spaces, and the 0.25 space per unit requirement for guest parking for units with two or more bedrooms would be removed entirely. The number of spaces required is based on unit size. Studios would move from a requirement of 1.25 spaces per unit to 0.75 spaces per unit. One bedrooms would move from 1.5 to 1, and two or three bedrooms would move from 2 spaces per unit to 1.25. Nearly all developments would still be required to provide about 1 space per unit, Kimmel said. We believe that's a reasonable floor for how much parking is often needed in Flagstaff. A household owning no cars in Flagstaff is probably not going to be feasible, probably going to need some off-street parking, but it may be feasible for a household to own fewer cars. He added that these are minimum requirements, and developers can add additional parking to their projects if they think it's necessary. He said other cities that lowered or removed their parking requirements saw developments still build above the amount required in order to better market the units. Surface parking costs around $7,000 per parking space to construct, according to the presentation, while tuck-under costs $20,000. While tuck-under costs $20,000, structures cost $35,000 per space, and underground parking costs $60,000 per space. So I guess they mean by structures, they mean garages. Developments with higher density or smaller lots may have to use the more expensive types of parking if there is not enough room on the site to accommodate surface parking. The recommendations also include incentives that would allow developers to further reduce the number of parking spaces included in a project. These are modifications to reductions already offered by the city. Incentive reductions to parking requirements would be offered to projects that are close to transit options, include affordable units, or offer trip reduction strategies like bike parking or giving residents transit passes. Kimmel said common concerns brought up about reduced parking requirements were that on-street parking would become more congested or off-street parking would not be available in places that did not have on-street parking. Additionally, the city's winter parking ordinance prohibits on-street parking for snow removal during several months of the year. We think these are legitimate concerns, and there will be tensions and trade-offs that are associated with reducing the parking requirements, he said. At the same time, these recommendations are designed to try to address some of those concerns. He noted that parking utilization studies find that perceptions of parking congestion are often higher than the reality. Kimmel advised the city to consider modifications to its winter parking ordinance as a way to make additional street parking more consistently available. But the specific way in which the ordinance should be modified was not included in the recommendations. We know managing snow removal is a major challenge for the city. We understand why the policy is structured the way it is. We also know that other jurisdictions that have high snowfall have implemented alternative snow removal policies and operations, such as alternating the side of the street by day of the week, only triggering full snow removal during major snow events, he said. Some of these things will still be a headache in winter months for people that are parking in the street, but it may make that space available more consistently than today. So we don't have a firm recommendation of how the winter parking ordinance should be modified, but we do believe it's an imperative to your housing and climate action goals that on-street parking be more consistently available during winter months. Incentives. The incentive programs for affordable housing and sustainability will be combined into a single three-tiered program. The first tier would incentivize developers to include additional sustainable design elements. The second tier is for those including affordable housing units, and the third tier is for projects that do both. Each tier includes more requirements as well as a higher level of incentives. What we're trying to do is make it rational for the developer to go to the highest level of affordable units and sustainable design, because the benefits of doing so outweigh the costs, Kimmel said. The presentation recommended adding a menu of sustainable design features that all projects will select from. It will also be moving the planned residential development standards to be by right rather than an incentive. As he said, most developers are already using this option. Sustainability options would move from four categories, with at least one strategy required from each, to a menu of 34 options under seven categories that developers can choose from based on the point values assigned to each option. Kimmel said in combination with the other recommended code changes, the incentives will not significantly raise construction costs per unit. The incentives for affordable units will also shift to having requirements for the percentage of designated units based on the targeted household income level for the affordable units. For example, a rental development would need to have 10% set aside for units affordable to households earning up to 60% of the area median income, abbreviated AMI, but 20% of units set aside if the affordability goes up to 100% AMI. These are also different based on whether the units will be rental or ownership. More information about the LASS/CAP is available at the flagstaff.az.gov website, and look for land availability suitability study. And that wraps up this article, which was titled, Council Hears Input on Zoning Changes. Our next front page headline story was by Sun Staff reporter Sam McLaughlin, and this one is titled, Havasupai Tribe Objects to Aquifer Protection Permit Change at Pinyon Plain Mine. The Havasupai Tribe is pushing back against a planned amendment to the state-issued Aquifer Protection Permit for the Pinyon Plain Uranium Mine near Grand Canyon, which would raise the allowable threshold for arsenic in a monitoring well at the mine site by 10%. The tribe depends on Havasu Creek to sustain its life and culture in the canyon and its thriving tourist destination, Tribal Chairwoman Melinda Yaiva wrote in an open letter. This is all at risk of being eliminated if the water is contaminated. It is no secret that the tribe adamantly opposes the Pinyon Plan mine. The Arizona Department of Environmental Quality, abbreviated ADEQ, stated in its June 23rd public notice of the permit amendment that increased arsenic levels detected since 2024 were not due to the addition of pollutions to the aquifer from the facility's discharge. This conclusion follows the opinion of mine owner Energy Fuels Resources Incorporated. The company contends that the increased concentration of arsenic is a result of, quote, perched groundwater in the vicinity of the site flowing toward the shaft, unquote, which it called a natural phenomenon. ADEQ has already changed its position on the amendment slightly in response to opposition from the tribe and elected official, recategorizing it from a minor amendment not requiring public notice to an other amendment. Though there is no formal public comment period for an other amendment, the tribe is urging members of the public to contact ADEQ directly. While ADEQ is not required to accept formal comments under an other amendment, we ask you to join the Havasupai tribe in letting ADEQ know that attempting to sneak an amendment by the public, which diminishes environmental regulation and allows for greater pollution of our limited groundwater, is not acceptable, Yaiva wrote. We should all expect more from ADEQ in protecting our precious water resources that benefit not only the Havasupai tribe, but all citizens of the state of Arizona. We will continue to fight mightily and not rest until this mine is shut down and Mother Earth is restored and returned to a state of harmony and peace, she added. Pinyon Plain Mine was established in the 1980s and originally called the Canyon Mine. The mine site is about 6 miles southeast of Tucson, not far from the boundary of Grand Canyon National Park. The mine was inactive for most of its lifespan. Energy Fuels began extracting uranium there in late 2023 as the market value of the mineral climbed. The Havasupai tribe has opposed the mine from the beginning. The tribe fears contamination from mining could affect the Coconino Aquifer, which feeds the springs that sustain life in the village of Supai. Other opposition has come from the Navajo Nation, which the company's ore trucks cross on their route from the mine to the White Mesa Uranium Mill in southern Utah, from the Ute Mountain Ute tribe who live near the mill site, and from conservation groups. Energy Fuels has consistently denied that the mining, hauling, and processing operations pose any threat to communities or the environment. But such promises have never been accepted by the mine's critics, who have often cited the extensive record of broken promises made by prior mining companies in this region and the legacy of abandoned mines and radioactive contamination they left behind. Amber Raimondo, energy director for the Grand Canyon Trust, said the move by ADEQ to change acceptable arsenic levels in monitoring wells was not grounded in solid evidence. Monitoring wells are one of the most important tools the public and tribes have for peace of mind that a mine operation isn't impacting groundwater, Raimondo said. The mine operator is asking for a regulatory pass based on a poorly justified assumption that the arsenic increases are natural. Energy Fuels and ADEQ know that the public is very concerned about the risks the mine poses to groundwater. Yet we discovered the issue by chance almost a year after arsenic increases were first detected at the well. If ADEQ ultimately decides to approve Energy Fuels' request, It will be at the cost of public trust, she added. Arizona is in a water crisis. We expect more transparency from ADEQ and stronger accountability for the mine operator. Opposition to the mine has spurred protests in Flagstaff and along the haul route since production began in 2024. In contrast with this local pushback, Energy Fuels has benefited from the federal government's interest in boosting domestic uranium production, which is considered a priority for President Donald Trump's administration. Earlier this month, Energy Fuels announced it had obtained conditional approval for a $725 million loan from the Department of Defense's Office of Strategic Capital, quote, to support the planned expansion of the company's critical minerals processing capabilities at its White Mesa Mill, unquote, among other projects. The company also announced that it had produced about 1.6 million pounds of finished U308, triuranium octoxide, more commonly known as yellow cake, at the White Mesa Mill in the first 6 months of 2026. Because mining at Pinyon Plain is currently progressing through lower grade areas, generating fewer pounds of U308 than the mill can process each month, mill operations were scheduled to pause for the third quarter before resuming later this year. The company expects to mine approximately 750,000 to 850,000 pounds of contained U308 in ore during the first half of 2026, a June 11th investor update stated. In the second half of 2026, grades and tonnage are expected to increase. And that article was, Havasupai Tribe Objects to Aquifer Protection Permit Change at Pinyon Plain Mine. Before continuing, I'd like to remind you that you're listening to news from the Arizona Daily Sun in Flagstaff, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. Sun Sounds provides programming directed primarily to those who cannot use print material due to a disability. You can learn more about Sun Sounds operations at the website sunsounds.org, and you can also listen to various live streams, news from various sources, magazines, etc. So check it out. All right, back to front page headline news stories, and this is our third and final in that category, written by Sun Staff reporter Calliope J. Ludeker. This is titled, Flagstaff's Drone Show is a Stunning and Safe Alternative to Fireworks. Discover Flagstaff is teaming up with Open Sky Productions to light up the sky this Independence Day. In lieu of fireworks, Flagstaff's Drone Show returns for its second year. This season's wildfires are a stark reminder as to why pyrotechnics are no longer an option in Flagstaff's dry climate. People have a sentimental attachment to fireworks, but considering the history of wildfire, it's just not something the city of Flagstaff is going to do anymore, said Ryan Rondazzo, media relations and marketing project manager at Discover Flagstaff. Pet owners can also rest easy. Aside from minimizing fire risk, the drones operate quietly. We go through our seven-step safety process multiple times because safety is paramount in our business, said Eric Merko, Vice President of Marketing and Business Development at Open Sky Productions. Our pilot and co-pilot keep a stringent watch for weather-related issues and ensure we are ready to go by flight time. This year's event will take place at Fox Glen Park at 4200 East Butler Avenue. There is no parking at the venue. Guests are instead asked to park at Flagstaff Mall or the P62 lot at West McConnell Drive and East Pine Knoll Drive on NAU's South Campus. A free park and ride shuttle operates every 20 minutes from 4 to 8 p.m. Folks can bring whatever fits on their lap. We're asking everyone to limit what they bring on the park and ride buses, just to make sure everyone has room and is comfortable, Randazzo said. Guests are encouraged to bring water, sunscreen, chairs, and blankets, but no drag-along coolers and no big canopies. The 30-minute show consists of 400 drones and took more than 100 hours to choreograph. Launch and landing are pretty awesome, along with the faux fireworks at the end of many shows, Mirko said. Truly, the designs in the sky, no matter what they are also incredible. Randazzo and Discover Flagstaff decided to move the show to a designated area upon the realization that, unlike fireworks, the view was not optimal from all directions. I knew there would be a good show from Buffalo Park, but I tried to see it from along Cedar Avenue east of where they launched at Coconino High School. It wasn't an ideal experience, Randazzo said. I knew what the images in the sky were going to be, but they were absolutely not recognizable. Beginning at 4 p.m., activities at Fox Glen Park include face painting, live music, games and bounce houses, with the drone show scheduled to begin at 9 p.m. The park and ride shuttle will resume following the show. Parking permits for Sanagua Middle School can be secured online at pros.flagstaffaz.gov/flagstaff/programs. Drone shows continue to improve and show promise of becoming the new standards in aerial displays. I believe they will continue to evolve with technology, Mirko said. Recently, the addition of pyro brackets has allowed for pyrotechnics within shows. We have seen the usage of lasers and LED screens, so the sky is not the limit. And that was Flagstaff's drone show is a stunning and safe alternative to fireworks. And again, that wraps up our front page headline news coverage for today. Next up, we have an installment of coverage related to the upcoming primary election in Flagstaff. This is candidate question number 2, election 2026. What did Flagstaff City Council do well or not well? With the local city council election in November and a primary in July, the candidates for the Flagstaff City Council, who will appear on the ballot, have been given the chance to answer a weekly question in no more than 150 words. These responses are unedited unless a candidate goes over that limit, so you can hear their answers in their own words. This week's question, what did the city council do well over the last 2 years? And or what is an area in which they could have done better? And here are the responses from council candidates, beginning with Nancy Baca. Over the past 2 years, the city council has made meaningful progress in areas such as public safety, wildfire mitigation, water security, and long-term infrastructure planning. These investments are essential to protecting our community and preparing Flagstaff for future growth. The council has also continued efforts to address housing and support economic development. At the same time, I believe the city can do better by placing a stronger emphasis on affordability and fiscal responsibility. As an economist, I believe every budget decision should be measured by its value to taxpayers and its impact on the cost of living. Residents expect the city to prioritize core services like public safety, roads, water, and infrastructure while carefully evaluating new spending. I would also support greater transparency in budgeting and clearer communication about how projects are prioritized and funded. Building on recent successes while remaining focused on responsible financial stewardship will help ensure Flagstaff remains a strong, affordable community for current and future generations. And here's the next candidate response, this one from Patty Hansen. One area where the City Council has been effective is partnering with Metro Plan Flagstaff, ADOT, Mountain Line, Coconino County, and other regional partners to secure transportation funding. These collaborations have helped advance projects such as the Lone Tree Overpass and bring millions of dollars in federal and state transportation grants to Flagstaff. Where the council could do better is public engagement. Too many residents feel they are heard only during the few minutes of public comment at council meetings or through email. Council meetings are designed to conduct the city's business, not foster meaningful dialogue between residents, council members, and city staff. I would hold regular town halls to create two-way conversations before major decisions are made. Good public engagement means listening early, considering diverse viewpoints, and giving residents a meaningful role in shaping city policies rather than relying primarily on appointed committees. Here's the next response from candidate Cara House. Over the last 2 years, the council made meaningful progress on housing, community resilience and sustainability, and strengthening the financial stability needed to deliver essential city services. I'm proud of my work to support expanded housing options, strengthen partnerships locally and nationally, and grow our awareness of and voice in community behavioral health. At the same time, there's always room for growth. We can do better at focusing on the issues residents experience every day, engaging the community earlier in major decisions, and continuing to push for enhanced local control. We should continue addressing housing affordability and attainability challenges, advancing protections that ensure everyone feels visible and valued in Flagstaff, and supporting the things that keep our community safe and resilient. Good leadership isn't about making decisions for people, it's about making decisions with them. I'm committed to continuing to include broad community voices in all my decisions on council. Next response is from candidate CJ Luck. Recently, the city completed 16 major post-fire flood mitigation projects. Flagstaff residents agreed to fund $26 million for these spruce wash projects in a 2023 bond. These projects work together to divert monsoon floods and stop water and mud damage to Grandview and Sunnyside area homes and streets. The council acted quickly to prepare the bond measure for adoption and recognized that Sunnyside was a traditionally underserved area, which was rightfully the highest priority. Police and fire services continue to be underfunded. Half of the $122 million general fund is allocated to public safety, but this isn't enough to construct Fire Station 7 or fund enough officers in either service. The council should start earlier looking at a line item budget and working diligently at the state level to allow local control of property tax rates for second homes. Learn more at cjluck.com. And here's the response from candidate Lori Matthews. Over the past 2 years, this council has made great strides in addressing our housing challenges. We ensured the $20 million housing bond funds were used effectively to meet citizens' most pressing needs. We advanced workforce housing policies, including incentives I introduced for affordable development and streamlined review processes that reduce unnecessary barriers. I'm proud of these efforts, which are beginning to move the needle. In 2024, the council approved a land availability and suitability study and code analysis project, now complete. I look forward to the next steps, citizen input, council review and discussion, and hopefully by year end, adopting recommendations. These will increase housing stock through higher densities, flexible zoning, and policies encouraging workforce housing and infill development. The council must continue placing strong emphasis on workforce housing, which I expect will be advanced through the recommended zoning and land use reforms. And here's the response from candidate Drew Stanley. An instance where the council did well is how they ultimately handled the Flock camera situation. I appreciated that council members were willing to be responsive to the community in removing them, even if some personally disagreed with that and wanted to keep them. It's important at times to be willing to set one's personal opinions to the side when met with the clear will of the community. However, I do feel that there have been occasions in the last couple of years where the council has failed to be transparent enough of certain decisions. The initial adoption of the flock cameras as a consent agenda item was a mistake in that it did not provide sufficient review for a brand new policy. As a counselor, I will ensure that the public always has the opportunity to have the final word on any legislation. Next candidate response is from Austin Aslan. Council tackles many of Flagstaff's long-term challenges well: housing affordability, wildfire resilience, water security, and climate preparedness. Where we can improve is exercising our role as policymakers more proactively. Too often, councils wait for a controversy before having policy conversations. Whether it was AI flock cameras, the hospital rezoning, the Desert Mountain energy litigation, or policies toward how to react when ice comes to town, our council needs to be better at establishing clear public policy before disputes force our hand. That means discussing community values, legal authorities, and emerging technologies openly with residents at the table. I've long encouraged council to think more strategically about the powers we have and not just react to the decisions immediately before us. Good governance isn't simply voting on staff recommendations. It's setting clear policy that gives staff direction, provides the public certainty, and helps avoid preventable conflicts down the road. And that wraps up the candidates for city council, but we have also a response to share from mayoral candidate Becky Daggett. Public trust is essential, and the city and council have made communication a priority. Decisions must be thoughtfully arrived at and must include the public. We work to make processes transparent, understandable, and to ensure that public input is carefully considered. The decisions we're faced with are often challenging, and it's impossible to have full agreement among all residents, but I work to consider as many perspectives as possible and to clearly communicate my reasoning. My weekly calendar is on the city's website, and it's my priority to be accessible to local residents, organizations, and institutions. Clear and timely communication takes work, and I promise to continue making this a priority. It's my honor and privilege to serve as Flagstaff's mayor, and I'm grateful for your trust. And that article was candidate question number 2. What did Flagstaff City Council do well or not well? Next up, an article by Sam McLaughlin titled, Firefighters Make Progress on Pocket Fire, but Smoke Likely to Linger. And if you're anywhere in or around Flagstaff, you've certainly dealt with smoke this week. 2 weeks after the pocket fire ignited in the steep rim country south of Flagstaff, firefighters have made significant progress establishing containment lines. Confirmed containment was up to 25% on Friday morning, and several communities north of the fire had their evacuation status downgraded. The threat of continued northward spread has diminished substantially since last weekend, when intense winds drove the fire multiple miles past one early containment line. However, fuels within the fire perimeter continued to burn and smolder, sending a plume of heavy smoke into the Flagstaff area. That's unlikely to change this weekend. Unfortunately, the wind direction over the next several days, each afternoon, is basically going to be pointed at Flagstaff. Air Quality Resource Advisor Mark Struthwolf told the Arizona Daily Sun on Wednesday. Since the fire's ignition, the prevailing daytime winds have been from the southwest, pushing smoke to the northeast. At night, The wind typically switches direction, sending some smoke down into the Sedona area. Over the past week, that cycle has been evident in Flagstaff, where clearer morning air gives way to haze and even ash later in the day. The overall good news is that any one area is not going to be under the smoke 24 hours a day, Struth Wolf said. The plume of smoke is relatively narrow and can be nudged east or west by little oscillations in the wind. Traveling just a few miles may be enough in some areas to find cleaner air. The total smoke production from the fire is difficult to predict. It's so dependent on the amount of fire on the ground. It's always a gamble as far as forecasting how much, Struth Wolf said. Though the incident management team is hopeful that fire activity will decrease as the fire consumes the majority of available fuel, that's not a guarantee. Continued growth, or simply the ignition of pockets of previously unburned fuels within the perimeter, could lead to higher intensity fire activity and increased smoke. On Thursday morning, fire officials warned that an alignment of terrain and wind in the upper reaches of Secret Canyon will likely produce significant smoke. There are no indications in the weather forecast that the consistent wind behavior seen over the course of this week will shift in a major way, or that any serious precipitation is imminent. It may be a while yet before Flagstaff sees complete relief from the smoke. Additional information, including an air quality map and recommendations for dealing with smoke in the air, is available at fire.airnow.gov. Making progress. The reduction in wind speeds this week has been a boon for the crews working on the ground. Containment lines along Forest Road 535 and 231 were declared confirmed on Wednesday morning, meaning fire managers are confident the fire won't spread past those lines. The total fire area was mapped at 23,451 acres on Friday morning, surpassing the final acreage of 2014 Slide Fire, which was 21,227 acres. Much of the growth in acreage over the past week was the result of burnout operations in which firefighters preemptively ignite fuels to prevent the fire from reaching containment lines with momentum. Lower winds also mean aerial operations can continue, and repeated drops of retardant and water have helped slow the fire's progress in key areas. Because of the complexity of the landscape, the fire remains dynamic and is far from over, the incident management team cautioned in their Wednesday morning update. Fire crews are working to create dozer lines on both the north and south side of West Fork Canyon to prevent the fire from escaping the upper reaches of that canyon with renewed intensity, and simultaneously looking for an advantageous position to stop the fire from backing down the canyon. More than 1,100 total personnel were still assigned to the fire as of Friday morning. The neighborhoods of Kachina Village, Forest Highlands, and Pine Dell were moved to ready status on Wednesday, down from set. Oak Creek Canyon remains in set status, and Highway 89A is still closed to the public. Lake Mary is closed to recreation because it is in use as a dip site for firefighting aircraft. And that article was titled, Firefighters Make Progress on Pocket Fire, but Smoke Likely to Linger. That brings us to Letters to the Editor, the opinion section here. So let's see what's on the minds of people around Flagstaff in the area. The first letter is headlined, Put Flagstaff's Heritage First. This letter is to commend the Heritage Preservation Commission, abbreviated HPC, for their stand to preserve the former City Hall on North Beaver. The recent Arizona Daily Sun article mentions comments that say, few locals are interested in historic preservation. I disagree, as many residents support preservation, but are discouraged by the obstacles created by the city. The article quotes a statement that visitors don't come here for the buildings, perhaps, but once they experience the uniqueness, they are impressed with the Malpai structures and often make a connection to the past when they see the fossils embedded in the stone. The developer chose this property as it is in the historic district, so the plan to raise the significant city hall structure clearly shows their lack of empathy and respect for our history. I strongly encourage city council and staff to back the HPC ruling and put Flagstaff's heritage first. Signed, Susan Olberdeen, Flagstaff. Next letter, catastrophic fire is the norm without the timber industry. I told them that the forest would burn. For decades, I've watched with sadness as wildfires have destroyed the forests I grew up in, along with homes and communities. My family spent four generations running sawmills and working in the forests of Arizona, Utah, and Colorado. We believe deeply in responsible forest stewardship. In 1952, my father moved our family to Fredonia and later Flagstaff, where he operated sawmills on the Kaibab and Coconino National Forests. I followed in his footsteps, working in the forests and mills. But by the 1990s, everything began to change. Efforts to thin the forests were increasingly blocked by radical environmental groups using legal challenges to stop nearly every timber sale offered by the U.S. Forest Service. Some even told me that their goal was to shut down all lumber companies and let Mother Nature manage the forests. Eventually, regulations, especially those protecting birds like the northern goshawk, ended timber sales in our region. With no logs to mill, I had no choice but to close our sawmills in Fredonia, Payson, and Panguitch. Hundreds of hardworking people lost their jobs. The day I closed the Fredonia sawmill, I told those present that it was not fair to the forest. It was going to burn. I warned anyone who would listen, including in an interview with Tom Brokaw of NBC, that without active forest management, we were headed toward massive, destructive fires throughout the West. Today, the sawmills are gone and catastrophic wildfires have become the norm. Forests have been allowed to accumulate dangerous fuel loads, making disaster inevitable. As fires continue to break out, the same groups who fought forest thinning are nowhere to be found. They prefer to blame global warming rather than acknowledge the consequences of their actions. Mother Nature has indeed taken vicious control over the forest after we humans failed to care for it. Without the timber industry as a partner, the Forest Service has extremely limited options for managing forests wisely. I only hope future generations find a way to restore balance before our forests are lost. Will we ever learn? Signed, Bruce Whiting, Phoenix. Next letter, congratulations on a successful Flagstaff Piano Festival. Congratulations to Sylvain Negrusiu, Director of Piano Studies at NAU, his piano colleagues in NAU's Kitt School of Music, Amy Fincher and Ken Osowski, and Michelle Wachter, Executive Director of the Flagstaff Symphony Orchestra. The fifth annual Flagstaff Piano Festival, Academy and Competition, was a truly joyous and enriching community event. The week-long festival brought to Flagstaff five world-renowned guest pianists whose recitals were of the highest caliber and whose master classes, open to the public, for the 19 Student Academy participants showcased state-of-the-art piano pedagogy. Academy student participants from around the country had a full week of individual lessons, group lessons, practice sessions, seminars, individual performances at NAU's Kitt Recital Hall in Lowell Observatory, and extracurricular activities in and around Flagstaff. Thanks to Lowell Observatory for partnering with the Flagstaff Piano Festival by offering up their facilities for Festival Academy young artists for the Starry Night concert in Lowell's Astronomy Discovery Center. Because of the high winds experienced in Flagstaff this last weekend, the closing student performances scheduled for Agassiz Lodge at the Snow Bowl had to be moved to the Kit Recital Hall atrium. Hopefully, the Arizona Snow Bowl can host students culminating piano recitals in the future for a high-altitude experience. The NAU piano faculty are already planning the 6th Flagstaff Piano Festival for summer 2027. Mark your calendars for June 19th to 26th, 2027. It is not to be missed. We'll see you there. Signed, Frederica Stoller and Bill Grabe, Flagstaff. And here's our final letter. Rededicate ourselves to improving the American experiment. There will be hoopla galore for the nation's 250th birthday. Let's hope there's substance too. 250 is a number for both pride and fear. How do we avoid sclerosis that will result in our downfall? Why not make this a year to rededicate ourselves to improving the American experiment? How about a tax system that recognizes new financial methods and forms of income so that our richest aren't paying the least? How about re-engineering Social Security for a permanent fix that automatically adapts to changing demographics and work patterns? How about comprehensive immigration reform to strike a better balance among demands of sovereignty, smart growth, manpower, compassion? How about constitutional amendments to address clear flaws? Shouldn't we agree that corporations aren't people to reduce huge money in politics unleashed by Citizens United? Enact proportional representation to reduce unending cycles of gerrymandering that violate everyone's sense of fairness? Consider age and term limits that motivate office holders to accomplish as much as they can rather than to last as long as they can? How about reimagining our medical system to address embarrassingly high costs and low effectiveness? How about process changes to create a steep price for politicians who allow government shutdowns? We revere our founding fathers for their boldness. We need equivalent boldness in a new generation. In this birthday and election year, let's demand candidates with high ambitions for solving generational issues. Let's not let our national birthday end with the aching realization of a squandered opportunity. Signed, Robert Vane, Flagstaff. And that's all the time we have for news from the Arizona Daily Sun today. Thank you so much for listening. This news has been presented to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona, and this is your volunteer Flagstaff reader, Joe, wishing you a happy 4th of July. Actually, I guess it'll be the 5th by the time you hear this, so enjoy the rest of your weekend. Hope it's been a great holiday weekend for y'all. And stay safe and out of the smoke as much as you can. And I will catch you in a couple weeks. I'm going to be off for a little bit, but I'll see you then. Bye for now.